In February 1910, the future Virginia Woolf played the most famous practical joke in British military history. Blackening her face and masquerading as an Abyssinian prince, the young writer and her friends conned their way onto the HMS Dreadnought, the Empire's most powerful battleship. The stunt made headlines around the world, embarrassed the Admiralty, and provoked debate in Parliament. But who was the girl prince, unidentified at the time, and what was she doing there? Welcome to Afterwards. I'm Tabitha Sparks, English professor and associate dean of graduate studies at McGill University. And joining me today is Donnelle Jones, award-winning author and scholar with a PhD in literature from Columbia University. Her book, The Girl Prince, is a tantalizingly fresh take on the iconic writer Virginia Woolf, her deeply problematic stunt, and her ideas on race and empire. Donnelle Jones, it is great to talk to you. I so enjoyed your fascinating book.
It's so nice to be here with you today, Tabitha.
One of its more original approaches is that you lead and end with the obscurities and contradictions surrounding the hoax, rather than try to establish definitive events. And so your exploration illustrates the complex racial geography of the time and the impossibility of holding Woolf or really any of the players to logical or consistent ideological positions. And I want to hear more about how this context evolved for you. But first, for the listeners who haven't read the book, can you walk us through what happened?
The event launched, it got started very early in the morning on February 7th, 1910. Virginia Woolf, who at the time was the unmarried, aspiring writer Virginia Stephen, was living relatively unhappily with her younger brother Adrian in Fitzroy Square. And probably before the sun even came up, the most famous costumer in London, a man named Willie Clarkson, arrived at their house with his crew and dressed the hoaxers in elaborate costumes and extremely disturbingly for us, blackface makeup. And then they probably took a taxi over to New Bond Street to the celebrated Lafayette Studios. And there they had their photographs taken. And only then did they go to Paddington to get the 12:40 train to Weymouth. When they arrive at the station, a naval lieutenant is there, according to Woolf, so we don't know if it's true or not true. They had a red carpet rolled out for them. They go to the Admiral's launch, and it takes them to the Dreadnought, where Horace de Vere Cole, who was masquerading as a foreign office escort, introduces them to the captain, and they come face to face, Woolf claims, for the first time, unbeknownst to them, although I don't think that was true at all. I know it wasn't true, with their cousin, William Fisher, who was an officer aboard the Dreadnought. The fake Abyssinian princes go off on a tour with the captain of the ship. In the meanwhile, Horace de Vere Cole goes with William Fisher to the wardroom for tea. After about 45 minutes, they say their goodbyes. They go back to the station, go back to London. The Navy apparently none the wiser that they have been hoaxed. And then a full 5 days later, it explodes in the headlines. And I mean, it basically goes Edwardian viral. And it blows up all over the entire globe, this story. So it is a huge story. And other things happen after that. But that's the basic event.
So in reading the book, but especially in looking at that Lafayette Studio portrait of the hoaxers the morning of the hoax, it's so hard to imagine that particular blackface costumery being convincing. So there's this huge contrast between the sight of great naval expertise, technologically sophisticated battleship manned by officers who were in fact so culturally naive that they couldn't recognize the blackface. How do you explain that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that could have been part of it, but I don't think that is the real issue. I think the real issue is that this was a very well-planned hoax. So they get the 12:40 train. They don't get there till late afternoon. It's early February. Dusk is already starting. It's a cloudy day. It's kind of dark. But the other thing that I think plays a huge part in this, and this became very clear to me when I was talking to a current officer in the Navy. He said, look, if the officers accept that the people coming on board are what they say they are, then everybody else falls in line. So part of the hoax is taking advantage of the hierarchy. They also took advantage of the officers because they send a telegram 20 minutes before they're supposed to arrive. And the Navy is very used to doing these kinds of guest tours of international dignitaries. So this is a dog and pony show they're doing all the time. Plus, I believe they had an inside man who yes. really helped them organize it in such a way that they spent a very limited amount of time with anybody who might question who they were. So I think that it is amazing they got away with it. Certainly, there was a lot of discrimination against people of color, people of African descent. All that plays a part in it. But I think it was also very well planned in such a way that it took advantage of the structure of the Navy, of the time of day, of keeping people who might recognize them away from them. And so I think it was a sophisticated hoax.
Yes, I think so too. And you do make an extremely convincing case for the inside man argument. I really enjoyed that part. And it does help retroactively explain how the lack of language skill and the sort of impromptu visiting could have been facilitated by someone who knew what was going on. We know that Horace DeVere Cole was the leader of the joke, but can you talk more about how and why Virginia Stephen got involved?
If we look at the documents of the time, I think it's pretty clear that she got involved because this was a joke on her cousin. They hated right. their Fisher cousins. Right. Virginia famously said that the Fishers would make Eden uninhabitable. So the chance to humiliate this cousin that they found kind of pompous, I mean, she and Adrian jumped at that. And we have to be very cautious about how the people who participated in the hoax describe it, because yes. there's misremembering, there's fabrication, it's very complicated. I do think that at least for Virginia Woolf, it was meant to be a private joke. They had agreed in advance, this would be private, they just do the joke, and it's over. She never expected it to be in the newspapers. And so when it does get in the newspapers, I think that's shocking to her. It's not what she expected.
I was fascinated to hear that after it was exposed, probably as you write by DeVere Cole, afterwards, Woolf gave her first and only press interview. Is that correct?
Yes. It's called The Lady Prince. It's a right. little article about a conversation with the Lady Prince. She just talks about how she tried to be a very stoical prince because that's what she thought Eastern princes were like, and that she managed to keep her countenance when she came face to face with her relative. So it's a very kind of superficial interview. But the thing that I love about it is what they really wanted was her picture in evening dress.
Yes, that's right.
So they could publish it next to the article because I was surprised. Well, it really isn't surprising, but so many of the journalists who covered it wanted to play the hoax as a kind of high society hijinks. And they really characterized the hoaxers as these sophisticates and these socialites, you know, and they were of a distinguished family. But it's hard for me to reconcile Virginia Stephen, who yeah. famously went to these society balls and would sit in a dark corner reading Tennyson because she couldn't dance very well. And she just felt so uncomfortable with this society socialite doing these hijinks. And so I think they wanted to make them into things that at least not all of them were. I'm sure that Horace DeVere Cole was quite happy to be characterized in that way. So the other yes. thing that you have to realize, too, that each hoaxer had a really different motive for getting involved. They weren't unified in their reasons for being part of this hoax.
So after it was exposed, the stunt made headlines around the world and was even debated in Parliament.
Yes.
Can you talk more about how it was received at the time and what was the immediate international reaction?
It was mixed, actually. A lot of people absolutely loved it. And probably the most telling headline is from the Daily Mirror, who said, the Abyssinian princes who have made all England laugh. Another thing I found fascinating is a guy in a variety show in Weymouth turned it into a song for his variety show. You could even buy postcards afterward with pictures of the hoaxers in costume.
Wow.
And so it was big. And so some people just thought it was a good joke and it was funny and great. Now, other people, including members of parliament, were 100% outraged. They felt it was an insult to the Navy. It was an insult to the king himself, to king and country. And the Globe claimed that there were plenty of angry people around who were hoping they'd get a good thrashing for what they had done. Right. Surprisingly, too, Wolfe's friends, Clive Bell for one, thought that it was really inappropriate. Many members of her family were outraged. This was not the appropriate activity for a young lady from a distinguished family. That said, I mean, and this is what's so interesting, her name was never published at
the
time.
Right.
So it wasn't until the 30s when Willie Clarkson gives an interview to the People, I think it was, that her name even gets into it.
I think you wrote about this at some point, that there was debate about consequences and punishments of the players in the hoax. And Wolfe's brother, Adrian, was a barrister. Did they get close to getting in trouble, or was that not really a risk?
Oh, yeah, it was a big risk. They did come very close to getting in trouble.
What would have happened to them?
They could have gotten anything from a fine, actually a quite small fine, to a year of hard labor in prison.
Wow.
But there was only one crime committed. Going aboard the dreadnought was not a crime. Hoaxing the Navy was not a crime. The crime that they committed was actually done by one of their accomplices, an accomplice named, amazingly enough, Tudor Castle. And the crime that he committed was sending of that telegram right before they were supposed to arrive. And that violated something like the Telegraph Act.
So post office fraud, not any other kind of fraud.
Correct. And so that put the Admiralty in a quandary, because the only person that they could file a charge against wasn't even on the ship. And I think that's part of the deliberate planning, right?
Yeah.
Tudor Castle was also the person who bought the railway tickets. So they very carefully separated any financial transactions from the people who boarded the ship, because that's where you start to get into possibilities of charges. So the Navy, especially Admiral May, he was in charge of that ship. It was his flagship. He was extremely interested in having them punished and sent to jail. The Admiralty also, I mean, they did not want to be humiliated. And they also, the police started investigating it. So there were naval investigators, police investigators, and this is going on for weeks, and it's in the newspapers. Probably the hoaxers themselves would have gotten off, but certainly Tudor Castle could have gotten punished.
Well, the hoax, and you write about this at times, it's really interesting how this is set against a theatrical backdrop where black minstrelsy was a fairly common trope. How common was the use of blackface, either on the stage, off the stage, people in costume? Would that have been surprising to an Edwardian audience or not at all?
Shockingly, I would say for us, it was not uncommon at all. In fact, blackface had been one of the most popular forms of entertainment in England since the 1830s. I mean, people did these shows in churches, in fairs, in their own sitting rooms, and everybody recognized what you did. You put on black makeup, burnt cork, you know, you dressed in these kind of tattered clothes, you did these weird dances, you use this weird dialect. I mean, you can find handbooks that tell you exactly how to put on a performance. You can buy prefabricated costumes. I mean, this is one of the most popular forms of entertainment in Britain through the 19th century, but still popular in the early 20th century. There was a big theatrical house in Piccadilly. The Moore and Burgess minstrels would put on blackface performances 6 days a week, and they would sell out their 2,000-seat theater regularly. So it was huge. It was big business. Wolfe would have seen it when she and her family went down as children to Brighton. It was common seaside entertainment. She had seen blackface minstrel shows her entire life.
of Wolfe's works, nothing reminded me of the Dreadnought hoax as much as Between the Acts, which was the novel published after she died, which is about British pageantry in full bloom. It's a village puts on their annual pageant that sort of recaps British history. And the man from the pub plays the king, and there's all sorts of hilarious identities. And yet there's several narrative parts where the villagers are exposed to feel uncomfortable and something is not quite right. And it's really clear that Wolfe is poking holes in the spectacle of Britishness. And then the other thing that comes to mind is that part of the naval military strategy is the pageantry. And the Dreadnought is famous in part to preempt its use, which explains why these people would have been willing to take guests with 20-minute notice. They're proud to show off their ship because of the work it does in terms of their military strategy. That was fascinating.
Absolutely. One of the things I talk about in the book is this naval pageantry and how much the Dreadnought, which in by 1910, it wasn't even the most powerful battleship, but it is the star. I mean, the Dreadnought was used in a lot of advertising because it becomes this icon of British supremacy and British power. So it's used to sell cookers and nylons and, you know, whatever you want, bicycles, you know.
So as a symbol of sort of technological prowess and indomitable strength,
Yeah, and so the summer before the hoax, there was a huge naval display on the Thames, and it was a whole week long. The Admiralty broke out all the battleships, and a million people came to see this. And the Dreadnought was the star. And the thing that was so incredible for people, they were allowed, regular citizens were allowed to go on the battleships. And even though the Dreadnought was the admiral's ship, it did have limited hours. So people went aboard the Dreadnought and got tours of it. And so the Dreadnought was a household name.
I'm really interested in Virginia Woolf's account of the hoax in 1940 at the Rodmel Women's Institute. And I believe she wrote this down, and then it was it republished, or someone else referred to it in a biography? Is it a written account of the speech she gave?
Yes, it's a typescript. One of the more fascinating things about it is that it was lost for 40 years. There were like three pages that survived in different places.
Okay.
So people knew about it. They knew it exists. People had heard it. Obviously, the Women's Institute, and she'd given a version to the Memoir Club, but nobody knew where the actual manuscript was. It was found in the bottom of an archive box in a London museum. Right. And yeah, so we have the whole thing. And, you know, my interest in the Dreadnought hoax was as Wolfe's quintessential pacifist performance, right? That's what I was thinking about. And I thought, oh, if I read this, you know, her own account, I will now know what happened. But then as I started studying it, I was like, this is so full of fabrications, misremembering, literary devices, fairy tale devices. It became really clear to me this was not at all about describing the past, but about writing something for her present purposes, right? For July 1940, when she gets invited to the Women's Institute, she's supposed to give a talk about books. She talks about the Dreadnought instead. And you kind of have to imagine this. It's July 1940. Germany has just trampled Europe. The German army is crouched on the edge of the English Channel. The Battle of Britain has begun. The Luftwaffe is dropping bombs in Britain. And anybody who knows anything is waiting for a Nazi invasion any moment. So while she's giving this talk, she and all the ladies in this hall in this little village of Rodmill could have a bomb dropped on them anytime.
Any moment, right.
Any moment. And she's telling this story, which they found hilarious, by the way. People who were there remembered it as the funniest talk they'd ever heard.
Yeah.
But when we read it now, it certainly reads on one level as sort of this lavishly spun, nostalgic talk that's designed to distract her audience from the strains of war. But I really see it as kind of a counter-narrative to these dire predictions that Britain is a doomed nation, that they're going to be overrun by Nazi invaders and it'll be the end of their country. And as I read the hoax, sort of in stark contrast to the tragedy and disaster of Dunkirk that had happened just a couple of months before,
yeah.
She creates this comic tale of these young Britons who defy the daunting odds. They outsmart this military power. Her characters are these cheeky improvisers, and they easily, you know, outsmart this military force. So I think despite being in the middle of this war, being in extreme danger, and she knows she's in extreme danger, she still can't give up her pacifism. And she's really celebrating ingenuity, wit, cheekiness as patriotic acts.
Well, I was fascinated in reading about you. You really situate in Bloomsbury, especially, that there was a presence of Black people. This was not some sort of exotic identity that people would have been totally unfamiliar with. But where were the women? Because the Black people you talk about in Bloomsbury are either law students or noblemen or theatrical figures. And it's very hard to assign Wolfe's feminism into the hoax. You can see her pacifism, maybe. You can see her wit, definitely. But the feminism, where was that? Or was it just not there? Una Marson came much later onto the scene.
Right. Una Marson doesn't get there in the 30s. And really, I just want to say, in terms of my research, she's the first Black writer who writes about the hoax in a play. She parodies it. And right. One of the things that sort of shocked me at the time was that there weren't Black journalists or Black newspapers either reporting it or speaking out against it. And I think you're right. There were, you know, Bloomsbury in 1904, when Wolfe moves there, is considered a very diverse neighborhood.
Yeah.
There's lots of students from all over the world, a lot of people of African descent there. You wouldn't know that from her writing. You wouldn't know that in 1910, when she and Adrian were living in Fitzroy Square, that African law students lived two doors down.
Right.
And two of them were Pixley Seme and Alfred Mangena, who would go on to become South Africa's first Black barristers and drivers in the African National Congress, who were fighting for the rights of non-white people. But I think you really tap on something with your question about the feminism, about the women, because I think, you know, so many of the people of color who went to Britain at this time in the Edwardian early 20th century period were often men because they were going to law school. And, you know, it wasn't until after World War I that women were even admitted to British Inns of Court, the law schools.
Right.
So
right.
It's the men, the colonial men, who are coming to the center of empire. So it is a very, I mean, not wholly, there are people, women of color there, but I would argue that it's mostly men of color. At that time, Wolfe is, she's part of Bloomsbury and she does have male friends, but, you know, she's interested in women and women's lives. And so the fact that the stories about Black people are male probably are of less interest to her.
Is there evidence besides the 1940 speech that have assigned sort of master narratives to the greater cause of this hoax?
Yeah, I mean, I think that as I was reading through all the memories of the hoax and the reports of the hoax, you know, I really thought about how there's a woman on board. It's about militarism. It's about hoaxing a colonial nation. All these things seem to be intertwined there. And that has meant that a wide variety of people have kind of taken the hoax for their kind of symbolic meaning. I mean, if you read the naval memoirs, these kind of disgruntled admirals like make fun of peaceniks by recounting the hoax in a really absurd way.
As if they come off better for it.
Exactly. And you see women, you know, lean into it for its feminist defiance. You know, you see pacifists. Look, this is Wolfe's pacifist act. And, you know, as I said, you know, once you get to the 21st century and our racial reckoning, then you start to get people concerned with social justice saying, you can't ignore the racial element of this anymore. And I think that for me, one of the most important tellings of that was a 2017 article in The New Yorker by Kevin Young, an African-American poet. And he basically said, look, this is a mocking of Black bodies. And he wanted to challenge his New Yorker readers to really confront the ugly racial underbelly of the hoax. So it has completely changed over time. Whoever's reading it has a different view of it. The story of the hoax continues to be very dynamic.
Yeah, and you've certainly reinvigorated the conversation. We finish the show by asking our guest about one source or text that influenced this book. Now, you just mentioned the Kevin Young article in The New Yorker. Would that be a turning point for you, or are there other texts that you see as generative in this process? Because you began the project before Kevin Young's article. You must have had other sources.
I would actually say probably the most important text would be one I stumbled across when I was very early in the process. So this is probably 2008, 2009. And I found this book by a Sierra Leonean writer and barrister called ABC Merriman Labor, called Britons Through Negro Spectacles. He lived in London from 1904 to 1919, and he writes this hilarious satirical view of Edwardian London. And I had never heard of him. I'd never heard of this book, but I fell in love with it. And after I read it, I wanted to know more. And there was nothing. I mean, there was like a paragraph about him. And so I did a deep dive and I ended up writing his biography. So I totally got into Merriman Labor. And that book made me realize I couldn't talk about the hoax unless I was thinking about Black British history, unless I was talking about Black British lives, because you really can't see it or understand it unless you see this world that is around it. So I hope that one of the most important things people see or learn from The Girl Prince is about this whole Black British world that is in Wolfe's world. She lived in this world, but it's hard to see in her books.
It was a real pleasure to talk to you. I just so enjoyed this book, and I'm recommending it far and wide.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Great questions, and I love the chance to talk about this time in history and these people who are so flawed and fascinating.
Afterwards is produced by George McDonough. Thank you to Danelle Jones for taking part in this episode. And you can buy a copy of The Girl Prince from the Hearst Publishers website. For more, follow Hearst at Hearst Publishers on Twitter. And to get the news on the latest Hearst books, subscribe to their email updates at hearstpublishers.com. I'm Tabitha Sparks. Thank you for listening.